And for that, Turkey will be the best option.
Analysts say Turkey will not only be hosting Hamas movement leaders and bureau, but will also take the lead in mediating to reach a lasting solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Turkey is trying to play a very important role that is bigger than working on reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. It is rather solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and trying to reach a lasting solution. The 7th of October was a turning point to start working on reaching a lasting solution, and I think Turkey's role is a key for it to maintain good relations with all sides.
Hamas had an office in Turkey since 2011, and Turkey mediated in exchange of prisoners. Turkish president maintains warm relations with Haniyeh and says he will always defend the Palestinian cause. Today's meeting takes place against the backdrop of Qatar potentially stepping back from ceasefire talks. This development could create a vacancy that Ankara is well positioned to fill, given Turkey's established relations, particularly with the Hamas movement, which many view as a strategic advantage. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, more than 70% of the fatalities of the brutal Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip are children and women. Likewise, according to reports issued by the Euro-Mediterranean Center for Human Rights, women and children in Gaza are enduring displacement, death, pain, and suffering in a way that the human mind cannot bear. More than 80% are living in tents without the minimum basic needs to live, without water, without food, with a chilling cold. The current situation is pushing them to the limit, making it impossible to focus on anything but survival.
Today, innocent civilians are placed in inhumane conditions which do not possess the most basic requirements for human survival. When it comes to children and women, the suffering becomes more painful because women's needs are greater. Women today live in tents. There is no bathroom. There is no toilet. They cannot take care of themselves. They have to stand in long lines in front of men's bathrooms, and this means double suffering. Also, do not forget pregnant women or those who gave birth during the attack. We're talking about an aggression that affects all vital aspects.
Pregnant women and those who have given birth in the midst of war are one of the most affected groups. Similarly, the United Nations Population Fund estimated that since the beginning of the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, approximately 60,000 women are pregnant, and of them, 5,500 would give birth soon, many of them by cesarean section. This means that terrible hospital sanitary conditions, as well as the food crisis, will endanger their lives and the lives of newborn babies.
Pregnant women are suffering from extreme cold, food shortages and medicine shortages. We have noticed an increase in the rate of spontaneous abortions, an increase in the rate of premature births, and an increase in cases of small fetuses. Pregnant women leave the hospital about 10 hours after giving birth and go to the tents, where they have no means of living. Newborn babies are exposed to many diseases. We have observed that a large percentage of these women return to the hospital with their children who have caught a cold, and some have also died.
The lack of hygiene and high levels of malnutrition experienced in overcrowded refugee camps are a poisonous mixture. According to the World Food Program, there is a high risk of famine, and cases of dehydration and malnutrition are increasing rapidly. Many mothers say they only eat once a day to survive. However, there are children who have stopped talking or eating because of what they have seen and experienced. Others cry and scream with every loud sound they hear. Months of war have traumatized an entire generation of children.
You see the atmosphere. Making bread is suffering. To go to the bathroom, you have to wait in line. To get water and foods, you also have to wait in line. That is, our entire life is suffering. In the tent where I live, there are approximately 8 people and my daughter, her husband, and her daughter as well. That is 13 people in just 9 square meters. We have to make the bread here, you see. And if we don't find cardboard to light the fire, we can't bake the bread. We only have one bottle of water a day and food. If they give us help, we eat. And if they don't give us food, no, because the price of goods is multiplied by 10.
The suffering we experience as children is that we have been forced out of our homes. Our houses were bombed when we were inside it. My friend, who was my cousin, has died. All my friends have died, and I have no one left. Our childhood has been stolen from us. I want to go back to my house. I want the war to end and return home so I can rest.
Gazans continue to call for Israel to fulfill its obligations under international humanitarian law, which begins with the protection of civilian lives. They assure that all they want is the end of this nightmare full of death and pain. Palestinian women have always been the symbol of the strong law of resistance. However, displacement, hunger, and lack of health care due to the Zionist war are disproportionately affecting women. They claim that even their dignity has been lost. And for that reason, they will never forget, and they will take revenge for these violations and the misery they are in just because of the Zionist regime. Hoda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
Chanting anti-Israel slogans and carrying placards with messages thanking the IRGC for conducting Operation True Promise. Thousands of Iranians marched down the streets in major cities across the country after the Friday prayers to voice their support for the armed forces and a recent punitive military operation carried out against Israel, dubbed Operation True Promise. The retaliatory attack was in response to Israel's deadly attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria on April the 1st, resulting in the martyrdom of top IRGC commander, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, and six other military officers. The punitive retaliatory attack involved a slew of drones and missiles targeting and causing damage to Israeli military bases.
There was a time when they could attack us and get away with it. But now the IRGC has proven that those days are over. I'm so proud of them.
We've been waiting for this moment for so long, ever since they assassinated Haj Qasem. I'm so grateful to our armed forces.
The IRGC really made all Iranians proud. We are so happy. That is why I'm here to thank them.
I was so happy on the night of the attack that I came out on the street to celebrate that the Israelis finally got what they have deserved after committing so many crimes.
The demonstrators also used the opportunity to denounce Israel's genocidal war in Gaza and its crimes against Palestinians.
We are here for the people of Gaza. I don't think any human being can watch what's happening and be indifferent.
Defending the oppressed is our duty. That is why I always take part in these demonstrations.
In cities all across Iran, people took part in mass demonstrations to show their support for the IRGC and Operation True Promise. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Instead of beating the drums of war, it is the delicate taps of instruments such as the dulcimer or the santur in Persian and the harmonious melodies of different tongues that should be wafting across borders. As Iran celebrates its National Culture Week in South Africa, officials and the public have visited exhibitions in the key cities of Johannesburg, Pretoria and Cape Town to learn more about the Persian heritage. The event was held at the Castle of Good Hope in Cape Town, which was a Dutch colonial fort and is now a museum.
Culture is a very powerful construct because it forces people to communicate, not only through language, because I can't speak the Iranian language, they can't speak Afrikaans, which is my mother tongue, but through our handiwork, through our art, through our crafts that we do, we can connect as human beings and exchange ideas, because culture is not devoid of power and of politics.
And this view is shared by South African officials, and even within the Organization of Developing Economies, BRICS Plus, which Iran joined at the beginning of 2024.
It's about looking forward to us coming out with a university of some sort. And that university is going to be a technology-driven university that has got culture imbued in it, because we cannot just be driven by, you know, gadgets and technologies. We have to put our humanity within this technology. If we can do that, I believe that we can go very far as a people.
South Africa and Iran have extensive relations, and so through expanding this exchange of unique arts and crafts, they can effectively use the skills of their respective peoples to develop economic ties and, within the framework of BRICS Plus, shape a new world which breaks away from the current system. Culture is important now more than ever, as it fosters understanding and can develop closer relationships between different peoples. In a world overwhelmed with conflict, exhibitions such as these are important for peace. Hassan Siria, Cape Town.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Mass murder after mass murder describes the reality of what the Israeli regime is committing on a daily basis in Gaza. Since October, the U.S. Israeli genocide has claimed over 34,000 victims, and the number is most likely over 40,000. As hard as it is to believe, some of the worst atrocities have been committed in places that are usually off limits during war, but obviously, that is not the case with this Holocaust against Palestinians. Hospitals, that's right, hospitals, have been one of the favorite targets of the regime. Why? Stay with us as we take a look at this and more on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver. And David William Parrott, academic author and journalist out of Scotland. Well, thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start this off with Charlotte. Charlotte, hospital after hospital in Gaza has witnessed major destruction and horror, mass murder, torture, and arrests have taken place at these facilities. Why do you think that hospitals have been one of the main targets of the Zionist regime in Gaza?
When you think about genocide, what we're fundamentally talking about is an attempt to exterminate a population, to rid an area of its people, of its population. And so this genocide in Palestine, of course, we've seen the horrendous crimes of the past 6 months against the Palestinian people in Gaza, but there's been a Zionist genocide against the Palestinian people for over 75 years now. And of course, if you want to take away people's right and ability to live, if you want to take away the fundamental parts of infrastructure that enable people to survive, that enable people to recover from the damage inflicted by this war machine that targets the most vulnerable, people with disabilities, elderly people, children and infants, then what do? You target hospitals and you target healthcare facilities. And what we have seen has been the systematic and deliberate targeting of hospitals and healthcare facilities while engaging in an international propaganda campaign to supposedly legitimize the targeting, bombing, besieging, and destruction of Palestinian healthcare facilities throughout Gaza. We saw it at Al-Shifa Hospital through two sieges, two series of attacks, two series of mass arrests, two series of mass graves. We saw it at Al-Nasser Hospital. We're seeing it at Al-Awda Hospital now, which was once again targeted just yesterday in Nusayrat camp. All of this is meant to make Gaza unlivable. It is meant to make Palestinians die or force them to leave their land. And one of the things that has really just stood out is the incredible bravery of Palestinian healthcare workers in resisting this genocide.
Yeah, really. Well, David, mass graves have now been discovered in the yard of the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, and the bodies of 283 medical staff, patients, and refugees who were taking shelter at the hospital have been discovered. I mean, shouldn't there be extreme outrage throughout the world, at least when doctors and patients have been targeted?
Do you know, your question almost beggars belief. I mean, the situation almost beggars belief. Firstly, let me do some polite protocols. It's a pleasure to meet Charlotte. It's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you for coming.
The pleasure is mine. You know, I'm not sure I'm the right person, to be honest. I'm a lifelong peacenik, a pacifist through and through, who's, I suppose, used to other types of engagement. You know, this type of warfare is something new to me. And I'm not claiming to be any type of expert on Sun Tzu or, you know, how warfare is waged. But when hospitals are targeted, I mean, there was a big hoo-ha in the international press at the start. Were they being targeted or not? I think it's quite clear to see now that they are. And it's unacceptable, really. You know, even if some of these facilities are being used, you know, with the intention of shielding fighters, and again, that's questionable, I don't think in this day and age that's an excuse. There are ways to find that out. There are ways around those problems. Any war on civilians is an outrage. It's terrible. You know, I'm here this evening to speak for peace, the ordinary Palestinian, and maybe also the ordinary Israeli, you know, who are being drawn into this situation. And everybody seems incapable of getting us out of it. I don't believe it myself. I think with a bit of goodwill and initiative, remembering the values that we all share, you know, I think humanity can reassert itself before it's too late.
Okay, well, Charlotte, I mean, when we look at the absolute absence of humanity by the Zionist regime, I mean, do you think that part of the barbarism we're witnessing is due to its total military and intelligence failure on October 7th and since then?
I think that's absolutely the case. What happened on the 7th of October was that the Palestinian resistance, I mean, in ways that built upon what the Lebanese resistance had done before, in ways that built on Palestinian resistance that has been ongoing throughout the history of Zionist colonization in Palestine, was show the possibility that the Palestinian armed resistance had the capacity to defeat the so-called undefeatable Zionist army, and that there was the potential to imagine a Palestine that was free of Zionism and a region that was free of U.S. imperialism. That is what happened on October 7th. All of the outrage, all of the shouts and screams, not only from the Zionists, but from, you know, world officials, you know, U.S. President Biden, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Olaf Scholz of Germany, Macron in France, all of these imperialist powers denouncing and decrying October 7th in the strongest of terms. I mean, because of the fact that October 7th was presenting material manifestation of the fact that, in fact, the Zionist project can be defeated. And that defeat that looks closer than ever. And the freedom of Palestine looks closer than ever. And so the Zionist regime and the imperialist powers responded the way that they always do to a rising of people seeking justice and seeking freedom from years of exploitation and domination. And that is through genocide, bombing, and massacres of civilians. They have not effectively targeted, nor have they effectively undermined the Palestinian resistance and its military capacity. They are not capable of stopping the resistance in Lebanon. They're not capable of stopping it in Yemen, and they are certainly not capable of stopping it in Iran. And they are instead attempting to win a pseudo victory through massacring civilians and bombing hospitals, schools, mosques, churches, and residential buildings. But of course, this is no victory at all. The humanity of the world is being defended by those who are part of the camp of resistance in the region and around the world. And it is in those examples, in the Palestinian resistance fighters, and the people of Yemen stopping the ships from resupplying genocide, in the Lebanese resistance emptying northern Palestine of soldiers and settlers, and of course in the retaliatory actions by Iran that are actually defending humanity against the rapacious attacks of Zionism and imperialism today.
Okay. Well, David, the first operation on a hospital during this genocide in Gaza was at the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital back in October. Now, during that onslaught, initially the regime tried to deny that it committed the crime. Now, so many hospitals have been targeted, and it doesn't even bother trying to explain the horror it is creating. I mean, what does it say about the regime in general and about the progression of this genocide?
Zionism's a strange beast in all sorts of ways. You know, I wonder if we're looking at the various rafts of Zionism coming apart, religious Zionism, political Zionism, which of course does not represent all the people of Israel and indeed all of the views that come out of Israel. I can't get over the fact a hospital was targeted in the first place. I remember reeling with shock when I first heard that news in the evening. I posted on my social media immediately saying, what has the world come to? I lost a couple of friends, Jewish friends. I hadn't accused anybody of anything at that particular time. And you think, you know, there are standards, common human standards, standards of decency that we throw away at our peril. I mean, it strikes me at the moment that international law is collapsing around our ears. You know, the order and structure of things after World War II, which was rightly put in place to try and make us all just a little more civilized, is literally coming apart at the seams. As you said yourself a minute ago, hospitals, churches, I mean, where does it all stop? We can't weaponize everything and remain human. I mean, one of the interesting facts I think about Zionism is, of course, there was an influx of Russian Zionists not too long ago. I don't think they're the most faith-driven people in the world. I mean, I remember seeing some interviews, reading about some interviews where they actually laughed at the idea of faith in Israel. Forgive me for painting in such broad brushstrokes. I don't have the figures and names in front of me, though I can get them. You know, and you think, well, okay, what is left if you're not fighting for that type of Israel? You're fighting for something artificial and you're fighting for something that really has little mercy on the surrounding people. I mean, I've had friends in Palestine for years. A friend of mine was the wife of a vicar. They all lived in Palestine together. I can't remember the book she wrote offhand. It was charming. You know, how before the State of Israel was established, everyone would go to each other's church, each other's mosque, each other's synagogue, and celebrate the seasonal rites together. All that has fallen apart, and now we're going to a new level of hospitals being attacked, sacred sites being attacked, graveyards being cleared. For me, I suppose that's one of the ultimate signs that humanity's gone out the window. The complete rubbing away of somebody's culture. It can't continue. What surprises me most is the aggression, I suppose, on the part of America and its proxy Israel in this particular instance. You know, there's a belligerence that I haven't known for a long, long time. It's depressing to see, and the complete lack of willing to discuss these issues is absolutely terrifying. You know, they're either for us or against us. The whole Biden regime, you know, that man can't get his head out of 1950s America. The world has moved on. You're either for us or you're against us. This simply isn't human, it's not rational, and it won't lead to peace. If I've got anything to say this evening on your wonderful show, is that we've got to find ways to reach peace. Further killings, further murders, further atrocities will not help anybody, and that's my view.
Right, well, indeed. Well, Charlotte, I mean, the regime has not reached any of its military goals in Gaza, nor was its intelligence able to prevent the Hamas October 7th operation. I mean, what does this say about the true abilities of the regime? Because it always tried to portray this invincibility in the region and throughout the world.
I think it shows that, you know, the Zionist regime is not invincible. The Zionist regime has never been invincible. It has relied on the weaponry provided by imperialism and its backing and support by Britain, the United States, France, Germany, etc., in order to maintain an image, a false image of dominance in the region. And that dominance has been established purely by having access to weaponry and technical support. I mean, we just saw the United States Congress voting to send another $26 billion in weaponry to the Zionist war machine carrying out a genocide. But the Palestinian people are the indigenous people of the land, rooted in the land, refusing to give up, refusing to bow down. I mean, the heroic action of October 7th was a statement that the Palestinian people will not be imprisoned, will not be subject to siege, and that Palestine will be free from the river to the sea, that that's not just a slogan, but that's a reality, and that that reality is going to be accomplished by all means that are necessary, including and led by the armed resistance, and in alliance with all of the resistance forces and peoples in the region. And this is something that is becoming more and more clear. And so we're seeing this absolutely genocidal conduct and targeting of every aspect of civilian life by a wounded beast, a regime that knows it has no future in Palestine and it has no future in the region. And October 7th was only the beginning of a new era of Palestinian revolution. It was only a manifestation of the fact that the balance of power in the world is changing, and that massacring civilians en masse and carrying out mass executions and the slaughters of children and healthcare workers and people is not going to maintain this unjust, illegitimate colonial settler project in occupied Palestine. It's simply not going to be able to do so, and they're not going to be able to rely on their weaponry in order to do so. Every single weekend, we see millions of people around the world in the streets for Palestine. Right now, we're seeing some of the most prestigious university campuses in the United States, where there is a student uprising going on, an occupation of campus, saying that we're not going to stop doing this until this university divests from the Zionist regime. This is a manifestation of the fact that people, even the people of the imperial court, do not want to be associated with Zionism, do not want to be associated with racism, do not want to be part of this war machine anymore. And so it's up to us to continue to take action to support those who are making those changes on the ground, led by the resistance forces, in order to bring an end to this genocide and bring an end to these crimes against humanity. There's a reason why the Columbia occupation and the Gaza Solidarity Encampment is getting so much support, because it's showing that every sector of society is done with genocide, is done with Zionism, and it has no future.
Well, David, what about Charlotte's comments? Because it just seems, you know, when we look at just basic humanity, after watching this, it's almost been now 200 days. Tomorrow will be the 200th day since this genocide has begun, that people, normal people, just cannot take looking at this and tolerating this day after day. And that's why we're seeing more and more actions in university campuses. Even people take the risk of being suspended from the university, losing their jobs. But I feel that growingly, just everyone is willing to do whatever they can, and they feel responsible to be able to try to do something to stop this genocide. I mean, your thoughts on that side of things?
You have to remember that huge marches are taking place across the United Kingdom every weekend at the minute to put a stop to this perceived inhumanity. You know, what am I perceiving personally? The shades of colonialism, the shades of racism, you know, all the things that dragged Europe down from its quite glorious heritage at one point. All of those old nasty colonial attitudes that are creeping into the discourse, creeping into attitudes, and, you know, we have to extricate ourselves from that, because it's done by a ruling elite in Britain, and maybe elsewhere too, that have vested interests in keeping the status and the quo, which of course isn't working. Despite what the Prime Minister says, a lot of people are very angry and very upset. you know, and they know. I mean, I can barely myself watch the images on TV. I can hardly look at them. But I know from some journalist friends of mine that they, you know, these are watered down images. They're not really showing the horror of the realities. You know, a young mother, a young lady with half of her hand shot away, a young toddler, you know, 3 years old, holding his tummy to keep his innards inside. And I remember saying to my journalist friends a couple of weeks ago, well, you know, obviously there are certain protocols, there are certain ways of dealing with reportage, but why isn't any of that being shown here? And they said they don't know themselves. And it's almost like there's a manipulation. Maybe there is a manipulation of what can be said and the way it can be said on the part of media outlets.
Mm.
You know, the idea was, I mean, I'm sorry for going on too long. You know, was a couple of complaints by my friends who'd better remain nameless at the moment were sent in to some very senior journalists heading certain departments at the BBC and getting the message back. This isn't evening time viewing. This isn't viewing for ordinary folks when they're having their supper. I can barely believe the inanity and the inhumanity of that as a response. But that is what is happening here. The careful management of a situation and what we learn and what we hear about the atrocities.
Right. Well, of course, Charlotte, I mean, what David's mentioning is something that has been going on for decades as far as manipulating public perspective. But we don't have very much time. I just want to go to the next question. The head of the Israeli military intelligence has been forced to step down due to the failure of the regime on October 7th. Now, his resignation is first of what is likely to be a long list of forced resignations or firings. Your thoughts about that, Charlotte?
One of the things that we've seen is that one of the reasons why Netanyahu is determined to keep this genocide going is because he doesn't want to be held accountable for the fact that he and his fascist government oversaw one of the greatest military defeats that the Zionist regime has suffered in the past 75 years. He doesn't want to take accountability for that, and he doesn't want to take accountability for the fact that every single day the Palestinian resistance is continuing to snipe their soldiers and destroy their tanks, and despite all of their genocidal TikToks that they post, the Zionist military is not achieving victory. In fact, it's being defeated every day by the Palestinian people and their resistance, and for that matter, by Yemen and Lebanon, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and all of the forces of resistance in the region that are coming together to expose the weakness. As they say, that the Zionist regime is like a spider's web. Its weakness is being exposed every single day, and they want to hang on to their power with genocide, bombings, and war crimes. And it's up to us to do everything that we can to make sure that they're not able to get away with that.
Well, David, I mean, from so many aspects, the regime seems to be imploding economically, politically, militarily. How do you see it?
It's certainly being propped up by America at the minute, which is outrageous. And, you know, it's got to this stage in America, according to my contacts, that even to side, you know, with the downtrodden, even to side with your ordinary Palestinian, now makes you tantamount to a terrorist. I mean, this is ridiculous. I was being told the other day by some friends of mine who were protesters over there, humanitarians and pacifists, that all they were doing was going up to senators on their way to their offices, maybe, you know, representatives, and saying, what are we doing as American citizens to bring some balance and to bring some sanity into this situation? And they were told they were terrorists. They were Islamic terrorists, they were Palestinian terrorists. I mean, the first thing we have to do is bring proportionality back into what we're saying to each other, a little bit of sanity into each other, and I can't, you know, with each other, I can't help feeling really that's one of the things that the right-wing regime of Netanyahu really doesn't want. I agree 100% that its failings and its weaknesses are being exhibited every day now. But, you know, the almighty power of America is going to keep it going for a very long time unless enough people say enough is enough and we start seeing things in their true light. You know, human beings are suffering without any real need. They're being starved. Malnutrition is being weaponized. Aid isn't getting through. You know, I know it depends on what part of Palestine you're in, but let's face it, overall, aid isn't getting through. And we've just simply got to say to Netanyahu's regime, enough is enough. You know, you can hold back the inevitable for a certain amount of time, but not forever.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network out of Vancouver, and David William Perry, academic, author, and journalist out of Scotland. And thank you for staying with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi signing out for myself and all the group right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
The Limelight.
A potential U.S. ban against TikTok took a major step towards becoming reality on Saturday, 20th of April, as House lawmakers approved a hot-button bill targeting the app. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The House of Representatives passed legislation on Saturday, 20th of April, that would ban TikTok in the United States if the popular social media platform's China-based owner doesn't sell its stake within a year. But don't expect the app to go away anytime soon. The decision by House Republicans to include TikTok as part of a larger foreign aid package, a priority for President Joe Biden, with broad congressional support, fast-tracked the ban after an earlier version had stalled in the U.S. Senate. A standalone bill with a six-month selling deadline passed the House in March by an overwhelming bipartisan vote, as both Democrats and Republicans voiced national security concerns about the app's owner, the Chinese technology firm ByteDance Limited. The modified measure passed by 360 votes in favor, 58 votes against, and now goes to the Senate after negotiations that produced a compromise. Even if the legislation becomes law, though, the company would have up to a year to find a buyer and would likely try to challenge the law in courts of law, arguing it would deprive the app's millions of users of their First Amendment rights. Court challenges could significantly delay the timeline set by Congress or block the law from going into effect. The company lobbied hard against the legislation, pursuing the app's 170 million U.S. users, many of whom are young people, to call Congress and voice opposition. But the ferocity of the pushback angered lawmakers on Capitol Hill, where there is broad concern about Chinese threats to U.S. national security and where few members use the platform themselves. "We will not stop fighting and advocating for you," TikTok's chief executive officer, Xu Zhiqiu, said in a video that was posted on the platform last month and directed towards the app's users. "We will continue to do all we can, including exercising our legal rights to protect this amazing platform that we have built with you." The bill's quick path through U.S. Congress is extraordinary because it targets one company and because Congress has taken a hands-off approach to technology regulation for decades. Lawmakers have failed to act despite efforts to protect children online, safeguard users' privacy, and make companies more liable for content posted on their platforms, among other measures. The TikTok ban reflects widespread concerns from lawmakers about China. Members of both political parties, along with intelligence officials, have worried that Chinese authorities could force ByteDance to hand over American user data or direct the company to suppress or boost TikTok content favorable to its interests. TikTok has denied assertions that it could be used as a tool by the Chinese government and has said it has not shared U.S. user data with Chinese authorities. The U.S. government has not publicly provided evidence that shows TikTok shared U.S. user data with the Chinese government or tinkered with the company's popular algorithm, which influences what Americans see. The company has good reason to think a legal challenge could be successful, having seen some success in previous legal fights over its operations in the United States. Last November, a federal judge blocked a Montana law that would ban TikTok users across the state after the company and five content creators who use the platform sued. In 2020, federal courts blocked an executive order issued by then-President Donald Trump to ban TikTok after the company sued on the grounds that the order violated free speech and due process rights. Trump administration brokered a deal that would have had U.S. corporations Oracle and Walmart take a large stake in TikTok. The sale never went through for a number of reasons. One was China, which imposed stricter export controls on its technology providers. Dozens of states and the federal government have put in place TikTok bans on government devices. Texas's ban was challenged last year by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, which argued in a lawsuit that the policy was impeding academic freedom because it extended to public universities. In December, a federal judge ruled in favor of the state. Organizations such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, have backed the app. Congress cannot take away the rights of over 170 million Americans who use TikTok to express themselves, engage in political advocacy, and access information from around the world, according to Jenna Leventhoff, a lawyer for the ACLU. CNN cable news network has also covered the same story. A potential U.S. ban against TikTok took a major step towards becoming reality on Saturday, 20th of April, as House lawmakers approved a hot-button bill targeting the app as part of a wider-ranging aid package. The bipartisan vote of 360 in favor, 58 votes against, marks the latest defeat for TikTok in Washington, as the embattled social media company with 170 million American users fights for survival under its current ownership by ByteDance, its Chinese parent company. The bill passed by the House this weekend closely resembles an earlier version approved in March of this year that would ban TikTok from U.S. app stores unless it finds a new owner and quickly. By attaching the TikTok bill to funding for Ukrainian military equipment, House Republicans put the pressure on U.S. Senate lawmakers to consider the whole package in a single up or down vote. Policy analysts expect the Senate to take up the aid package quickly, giving it high odds of passage. And President Joe Biden has previously said he would sign the TikTok legislation if it reaches his desk. The fast-tracking of the TikTok bill shows how policy priorities outside of the company's control have merged to create a potent and potentially devastating outcome for an app that's beloved by many young Americans and that U.S. officials say is a national security risk. The version of the bill approved on Saturday, 20th of April, would, if signed, give TikTok 270 days to find a new owner, up from the roughly 6 months contemplated under prior versions of the legislation. And the bill also gives the White House an option to extend that deadline another 90 days if President Biden determines that progress towards a sale has been made. TikTok has vocally opposed the bill. For weeks, TikTok has waged an intense lobbying campaign in a bid to defeat the legislation, arguing it violates its users' First Amendment rights and threatens small businesses. It is unfortunate that the House of Representatives is using the cover of important foreign and humanitarian assistance to once again jam through a ban bill that would trample upon the free speech rights of 170 million Americans, devastate 7 million businesses, and shutter a platform that contributes $24 billion to the U.S. economy annually. TikTok has hinted it could sue to block the House's divestiture legislation, telling users in March that it plans to continue fighting, including by exercising our legal rights. A court challenge over the law would set the stage for a high-stakes battle over Americans' right to access digital information. Until this week, Senate lawmakers have been divided over the House's proposal for a forced sale of TikTok. That shifted somewhat once the House unveiled its latest draft, featuring a longer deadline. And in the days leading up to the House vote, on Saturday, 20th of April, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer emphasized the urgency of approving the foreign aid bill. On Saturday, Chuck Schumer said in remarks on the Senate floor that there is a tentative agreement for the chamber to take up the foreign aid package on Tuesday.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel steps up its deadly strikes on the besieged Gaza Strip as regime genocidal onslaught against the territory enters its 200th day. Head of UNRWA calls for a Security Council probe into Israel's complete disregard for UN premises in Gaza after 180 of the agency's staffers are killed. And U.S. police arrest over 130 pro-Palestine students at New York University as a spate of anti-Israeli protests sweeps through major American campuses. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News. Over 200 days now into the U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide in Gaza, and the regime continues its attacks all across the devastated territory, killing more innocent civilians. In central Gaza, Israeli airstrikes and artillery fire continue pounding the Al Buraj and Nusayrat refugee camps. Several citizens were killed and a number of others injured as a result. And to the north, regime's attacks targeted Beit Lahia Stadium, killing and wounding several displaced Palestinians that had sought shelter there. Elsewhere, fresh shelling hit east of the southern city.